The first question regarding the gestational stomach fluid occurs in which type of hiatal hernia? Sliding type of hiatal hernia. And number two, the first order neurons of the sympathetic division for the whole body, you know, the neurons are located at what levels of the vertebral column? T1, 2, L2. And number three, what are esophageal varices? Pardon me? Enlarged, dilated, or varicosed esophageal, you know, veins. That means, or submucosal veins. These are, you know, the submucosal esophageal veins that are enlarged, dilated, or varicosed. And number four, if an infant develops pyelonephrosis, it usually occurs during, you know, what, you know, weeks of age? 2 to 12 weeks. 2 to 12 weeks. This is also in blue boxes. It was also gone over in class. And number five, because these are conditions that a physician can come across, pyelonephrosis, pyloric stenosis, these are things that you may come across in your practice. And which division of the autonomic nervous system increases the blood flow to the GI tract? Which one? Parasympathetic. Ascites can develop from what clinical conditions? Pardon me? Cirrhosis of the liver is one of them, and late stages of congestive cardiac failure, and peritonitis, and ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer, complication of ovarian cancer. I included that in class discussion. And it may not be in the textbook. That is why we have a class, and that's why I include some of the things that I get from other sources in class. And number seven, why do we consider some organs to be secondary retroperitoneal? Initially, those organs or those viscera were suspended, you know, by the mesentery. Then later on during development, they lose the mesentery and they come, you know, they become or they are located behind the peritoneum. What is a good example of it? I didn't ask you for it, but what is a good example of it? Ascending colon, descending colon, ascending colon, descending colon, and, you know, celiac trunk, a few others are there like that, okay? But ascending colon and descending colon, very easy for you to remember, to keep in mind, is because when the intestines come back, that means, you know, during development at some point, you haven't come to the development of the GI tract in embryology, have you? You are now there. And you might have gone, I don't know, you might have gone there that, you know, during the second month, after the 4 weeks, you know, the midgut derivatives are growing so fast, they have to go someplace. What they do is, they herniate out into the umbilicus. They just herniate out into the umbilicus, and then, you know, they're still growing, and then they come back in. After, you know, a few weeks, they come back in to the intestine, I mean, to the abdominal cavity. So when they're taking, their adult position, the what is called the large intestine that's on the periphery gets squished. The large intestine on both sides get squished to the sides. And so they are really pressed against, you know, the body wall. And when they sit there like that, they lose their mesentery. So that's an easy way of explaining, I mean, understanding, to keep in mind. But the transverse colon and the sigmoid colon, they are not squished by the small intestinal coils. So they stay free. mistake free. So that is what happens with those, and that's what is happening with any of the Visra. They lose, they're suspended at some point by the mesentery, and then they lose that mesentery, and then they are, you know, buried like right like that. Since you're in the abdomen, it's the right place, you know, to talk about this, and also you are in embryology at the same place, and so therefore, you know, that's a good time to kind of, you know, keep that in mind. And then name two naturopathic measures that can be employed to treat adhesions in the abdomen. Colon therapy and deep tissue work. Colon therapy and deep tissue work. I cannot incorporate naturopathic principles, you know, because I'm not prepared for it. I don't have the qualifications for it. But what I know about naturopathy, naturopathic treatments, I include and I discuss in class. That's the best I can do, because naturopathic principles have to be left to specialists that are in that field. So please do not expect me to be incorporating naturopathic principles and whole body, mind, you know, spirituality. I'm not a spirituality practicing person. I practice my own spirituality. So in relation, what I'm saying is, when people's expectations of me, please don't expect me to incorporate spirituality, mind, body, in gross human anatomy. It is difficult for me to incorporate. You know, I know gross human anatomy, so I will go there. But yes, Sarah first, and then, yeah.
Is it okay to say hydrotherapy?
Hydrotherapy, I don't know of hydrotherapy. If I'll ask a naturopathic physician, I'll ask Jamie Wallace at the clinic. I'll call him up and ask him. If he says hydrotherapy is one of the treatments, then I'll accept it. And just wait, the hands I will take, then I'll come to you. But if the naturopaths tell me, yes, take it, then I'll take it, okay? And you had a question.
What about ultrasound?
What therapy?
Ultrasound.
Ultrasound, is that a naturopathic measure?
Yes.
Okay, again, wait, let me write it down. Because I'm not very, up on some of these things, I need to consult specialists. And just because some people have it, I'm not going to, it's not that I don't trust you, I need to know it, okay? And so I need to ask, let me see, hydrotherapy, and what's the other one?
Ultrasound? Yes.
Okay, ultrasound, and, yes, Dr. Wong, yes. Myofascial, isn't that deep tissue work? Isn't myofascial, wait. 3-4 people speaking, I can't deal with it, okay? Remember, I'm an insecure person, according to, you know, a couple of you, you know, in, you know, so your psychoanalysis, let me make use of it. And so here, when only one person talks, and then I can hear it, okay? I will come to each of your questions, but just let me get this. Myofascial, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I understand, is part of the deep tissue work. That's what I understand. But again, Masa Takakura is the one I'm going to consult that with, myofascial. I'll ask him, myofascial and deep tissue work, what is the difference, I'll ask him. Because he's a specialist in that myofascia. And yes. Dr. Lin.
Do you know a kind of phase of movement?
I know what?
Phase of the movement, which is use your hand as a cooperative surgeon to adjust your organ.
What would you call
visceral manipulation?
Visceral manipulation. Isn't visceral manipulation also part of deep tissue work?
Yeah.
Yes. So visceral manipulation, deep tissue work, as far as I see, is the same. Okay. Dan. Okay. And yeah.
Could we just have everyone email you? They could probably have a
thank you. Thank you very much for saving time. because otherwise people are going to say that I don't answer the question and she seems secular, so she doesn't take the questions. And so I was trying to. Okay. Any other suggestions you have, you think is a valid point for this question as an answer? Please, you have to send it to me within 2 days because I need to call up as one of the specialists and ask them these things. Yes?
Why don't you just have people write down
their
brain so you'll
have... Email is writing, isn't it? Okay.
Where were we at?
Okay, now, where was I? What is, number 9, thank you. What is Kapha fascia? Kapha's fascia. Membranous layer of the superficial fascia of the abdomen. Number 10, what does the mesentery do? It connects and suspends an organ, you know, to the abdominal wall, conducts vessels and nerves to and from the organ. And what clinical relevance, what is the clinical relevance of the duodenal cap? Duodenal ulcer, site of duodenal ulcer. At what specific location does the hepatopancreatic ampulla enter the small intestine? The middle of the second part, the middle of the second part or the descending part of the duodenum, or if you say the greater duodenal papilla, is in the second part. That I also will accept. A stab wound involving which areas of the abdomen would, you know, include all coils of the jejunum? What regions and areas? Upper lepidus quadrant and umbilical. And number 14, what is the superficial inguinal ring? What is it? It's an opening in the external oblique aponeurosis. That's from the anterior abdominal wall when we're talking about the anterior abdominal wall muscles. Okay. Any other treatments you think is appropriate for, you know, the that question? I would, you know, expect it, you know, by Thursday. That means I will be looking at it and I will contact specialists on that and I will accept it if it is appropriate by them. Okay? And so let's move on and finish up the intestines. And we were doing the small intestine and let me see here. This is where we were in terms of the small intestine. Okay, here. So we have come all the way, you know, from here all the way down up to, you know, here, up to here. So we have done this part of the small intestine that belongs to which embryonic, what is it a derivative of? What is that small intestine a derivative of? What embryonic structure gives rise to the small intestine? The midgut. So the midgut derivatives I have done. What is left of that midgut derivative is here. That is the clinical note. The clinical note is what I need to do. When you look at the clinical note for the small intestine, you would see that where I finished was we were talking about the malignancy, and you've seen that it's not very common. Malignancy is not very common in small intestine. That is, you know, the information that we have, you know, from, you know, literature. And then ectopic pregnancy has happened and can happen in the mesentery of the peritoneal cavity. Even in Washington State, a few years ago, it had happened. And so ectopic pregnancy is not only, you know, in the fallopian tubes, but it can also happen in the mesentery of the peritoneal, you know, cavity. And the other is herniation. and herniation of the small intestine, loops of the small intestine are the very common, you know, structure that is herniating, you know, through various, you know, areas. Okay, and so that's one another thing. There is that we have is the Meckel's diverticulum. Meckel's diverticulum. Meckel's diverticulum belongs, or it is, okay. Meckel's diverticulum is a developmental anomaly that should not be there, but a lot of us could be walking around with Meckel's diverticulum and we may not develop any problems. Sometimes until the third, okay, say 30, 35, you know, years of age or somewhere there, sometimes, you know, people could develop or complain of what is called, you know, like pain, like appendix. Because this Meckel's diverticulum, this is from, you know, the embryology book. Your textbook also has a colored diagram of this. This is the first edition of Moore and Daly embryology book. I could have brought the book, but Doctor, you know, Modell borrowed my book, and so I don't have it. So I took it. Here is the copy of that. Here, the as you look at it here, here is the ilium. At the last part of the ilium. That means a few inches away from the last part of the ilium, where the ilium is joining, you know, the cecum, you may have a little tube hanging down, just like the appendix, just like that, and that is an abnormality that is called Meckel's diverticulum, or it is called the ileal diverticulum, or Meckel's diverticulum, ileal diverticulum, Meckel's diverticulum, or ileal diverticulum. If it becomes inflamed, this is the, you know, intestine, the ileum here, and so here we have the diverticulum is right here, projecting out here like that, hanging out like that. In reality, like normally, you see here that is the mesentery that is, you know, holding the, you know, the ileum that is attached to the body wall. So if it is there, it is not a problem. It's not a problem for us, but only if it becomes inflamed. If it becomes inflamed, it gives pain that, you know, mimics the pain of the appendix. And so, and sometimes people have to go in and, you know, do surgery to remove it. Or during embryonic period, you know, it is there, it exists there, but naturally, it is, you know, taken, you know, absorbed into the intestine. And your textbook has a very good diagram of that. So that is Meckel's diverticulum, and that can mimic the pain of appendicitis. That is the reason why I'm including, you know, the Meckel's diverticulum, you know, here, okay? And then we, am I slow enough for you? Is it okay? If it's not, you know, there's no point in waiting to write and let me know. Please, you know, just put up your hand and say that was fast, I don't know. You know, so that would be fine. You know, so then let's move on to, where's Andrew? Andrew, can you please help me with this? Because when I go to do that, I'm not able to continue here. Thank you. And you are in the IT department, you may want to look into this and see every class, you know, a few minutes. I have to. Yeah, that's okay. That's great. I may call on you next time. Okay? And so now I'm done with the small intestine. Let's go to the large intestine. Okay. You don't know that I'm planning to give him some little thing at the end of the year because he's helping me a lot. And large intestine, the general points about the large intestine, you will have to study. I'm not going to say read from now on. I'm going to say you will have to study on your own. That means, you know, the diameter, this, that, all kinds of general points, please study on your own. But the identifying characteristics of the large intestine, are included here. Tinea coli, Haustra, appendices, epicloicae, those are included here. Those you can see in the dissection lab. You might have seen it if you haven't seen it. But those are identifying characteristics. What else would you normally think, is an identifying characteristic of the large intestine, or what can differentiate the large intestine from the small intestine? Diameter. But diameter is not something that you can go by. I have seen, and time and time again it happens, the diameter of the large intestine may not be that different from the small intestine. Sometimes you may have problem figuring out which is it, where does it, yes. The diameter usually, in most people, is larger, but not in everyone. The small intestine, the diameter of the small intestine and large intestine may be just about the same, but then the distinguishing features should be these, and what are these? Anybody can ask you, what are haustrations, what are tinea coli, and because some of these are used in clinical setting, as you look at it here, when you look at the longitudinal layer, of the colon, you can see it. It is really kind of like a band. There are three bands around, the large intestine. They are called the tinea coli. So they have different names. I'm not going to deal with the separate names, mesenteric and medial and, tinea omentalis, all those. And here you can see them. And so that is one of them. And the others, as you look at it here, you can see how the longitudinal layer of the muscle fibers there is like acting as a band there. The other is Haustra or haustrations, like these sacculations that you see here. This one, this one, this one. These are sacculations, that are, also an identifying characteristic. And then, what are these? Appendices epiploicae. What are those? Little pockets. You see the little pockets only on colon, parts of the colon. Is the large intestine? Large intestine colon? Large intestine includes everything from the cecum all the way to the anal orifice. As you look at it, here, this one here. Okay, let me look at it. But the colon is where it was even on Jeopardy the other day. Imagine. You are on Jeopardy and you are a doctor and you don't know what parts are included in colon, what part is the large intestine. I just thought of it. I thought, oh, then somebody's going to say that, oh, no, she goes on a tangent. And so here, the cecum, ascending, transverse, descending, sigmoid, rectum, right up to the anal canal is your large intestine. The colon has its name along with here. Ascending colon, transverse colon, descending colon, sigmoid colon. Period. So rectum and cecum. Also, they have a little different structure when you look at it. Rectum and cecum don't have the appendices epiploicae. Those little pockets hanging from there, they're filled with fat. The rectum doesn't have that. The cecum doesn't have that. And so that's the difference between the large intestine and the small, colon. Okay. And then cecum. As you look at the cecum, I am not going to go over everything about it, but what is important about the cecum here is the ileocecal valve. The ileocecal valve. As you look at the ileocecal valve here, and the terminal part of the ileum, you know, fusing in, going in and fusing with, merging with the muscle layer of the large and of the cecum here, okay? That valve prevents reflux of food or the chyme or whatever has come in here back into the ileum. Back into the ileum, it prevents. That is a normal function of it. Okay, of this valve here. Ileocecal valve prevents that. That's one of the reasons why you may not find a whole lot of diseases with the small intestine, like the, you know, what do you call it? Because the small intestine is more or less, what it is handling is more or less very clean material. You know, the stomach acid and the contents of the stomach has, you know, taken care of a lot of bacteria and things. And then when it comes into the small intestine, you know, what is absorbed and what, it is more or less clean material that's coming down. That's one of the reasons small intestine, you know, is safe much compared to what we have in the cecum, large intestine, rectum, you know, colon, that part, because a lot more bacteria live, a lot more bacteria live, you know, in the large intestine. And so the ileocecal valve prevents the reflex of food items or whatever, you know, contents are there in the cecum back into the ileum. The other opening you see here is the appendix. You know, the appendix, as it is, you know, hanging, you know, from there, you know, it is, you know, also an opening. And so you can have, you know, if there is, you know, some, I don't know, what do you call, infectious material or something like that, even a little seed or something going and blocking here. But what prevents all of us having appendicitis, you know, because most of us don't, very few people have appendicitis. What prevents the appendix from developing appendicitis frequently, more frequently? It has lots of, you may remember from histology, that, you know, appendix has a lot of, you know, what is called the lymphoid tissue. You may remember the wall of the appendix full of lymphoid tissue. You know, a lot of it can be, you know, taken care of, you know, there before it becomes. And clinical note, I have, you know, gone over, you know, the cecal valve and the peritoneal relations of the cecum. What would you consider the cecum to be? Intraperitoneal, retroperitoneal? What would you consider it to be? Intra. It is intraperitoneal even though it doesn't have a mesentery. Because why is it intraperitoneal? Is because it develops, it hangs from colon, you know, the ascending colon. So as a result, sometimes, because it is extending down from the ascending colon during development, you may find, you know, the cecum to be subhepatic. In the subhepatic place, it has not descended. It has not come down. You may find the cecum sitting right up under the liver. Subhepatic position, it is called. Okay, so that is the other clinical thing. Appendix. And in case of the appendix, you as a physician may want to keep in mind the appendix is not always in this classical, you know, position. It is about 64% of it is what is called retrocecal, retro, behind, you know, the cecum. About 32% of it is in the pelvis even. You know, it would come into the, it is even hanging into the pelvis, and it is very possible for the appendix to be in the pelvis. As you look at the, let's look at it here, and so you, it's easy for you to understand that how it can be in the pelvis. And see here, see this is, remember, this is the true pelvis right here, and so it can be, you know, even a little bit more into the pelvis, and then it can also be, and let's go here. It can also be what you call retroileal. It can also be retroileal. So what I'd like you to know is that retroileal, so here's the ileum, so it could be curled up right behind here. So the appendix may be found in different parts. You know, that means different parts, meaning, you know, behind, here, there, and all that. And, you know, on an image that you're looking at, an X-ray image or some images, you want to keep that in mind. But also, the McBurney's point is internationally used to find the base of the appendix, because the base of the appendix always stays where it is. The base of the appendix is found. You can walk down to room 57 on Thursdays, and Tuesdays it is room 55 that we can walk down to. So you agree that I can stay in my office because I have a computer there and I can do a few things until you come. And so I know midterms are coming. And so, all right, and the book and the thing, yeah, that's it. All right, so let me move on to where we were. Appendix and McBurney's point is where I was pointing to. McBurney's point is used all over the world, everywhere. You need to know that. How to reach McBurney's point, what is the clinical significance of the McBurney's point, okay? The McBurney's point, you find the ASIS, anterior superior spine, then, you know, draw a diagonal line to the umbilicus, okay, like that. Divide it into three, where the lateral half, the lateral third and the middle third meet. That marks the base of the appendix. Because the appendix is found in different positions, the base of the appendix is constant. Okay, and so that is why, McBurney's point is used by a lot of people to find the base of the appendix. So it is a clinically very thoroughly used point. That means people can use it over and over again. You know, in this or that, you know, situations. And then let's move on to the ascending colon. Ascending colon is secondarily.
Could be louder.
Question. Oh, okay. Yes, Emily. Yes.
I'll hear if you have to find it again.
Have to find the base of the appendix? You find the anterior superior iliac spine, draw a diagonal line to the umbilicus from the ASIS, okay? And so here, let me go here and draw that here. Okay, here, that is the, here, okay. Okay, so here is the anterior superior iliac spine, and here is the umbilicus. Go like that, okay? And then, divide this into three. And then, find this point here, where the middle one-third and the lateral one-third meet. That's this point here. That marks the base of the appendix. That is called the McBurney's. McBurney's is somebody who, you know, McBurney's point. Okay? So that is how you do it. Now, let's continue. Is that clear, Evelyn? Yes, Sarah.
I was a little confused in the book.
Pardon me?
I'm confused in the book because McBurney's point is like an X. Does that mean they can cut in either direction or like that it's.
The
I mean, in terms of, as opposed to a dot, why is there an X?
Oh, they just mark, Yeah, why is there an X? They just mark the X. It's the point that is indicating the direction in which, you know, you would have, you know.
So you could cut either way.
Pardon me?
So the same that you cut either way.
Let me come there.
Okay. I thought they were talking about the way they would cut into a
person. They may cutting, I'm not very sure about which way they'll cut. These days they may not cut. You know, because these days they may use a scope. I don't know. You know, scope or they when they do the cutting. I'm not sure about the cutting part. You know, different surgeons use different way of cutting also. Like, you know, some people go what you call crosswise according to the, you know, the muscle fibers, how it is, you know, so they're just separating the muscle fibers. But I don't know for appendix, do they use the scope or the cutting? I'm not, you know, sure. Things keep changing though. In surgical approaches keep changing. And then ascending colon. Ascending colon is the next thing. Let's move here to the ascending colon. Here. Okay, as you look at the ascending colon, the relationships of the ascending colon to different structures, you may just take a look at it in the cadaver and or in the book. Now, what it does is it goes up right below the liver. It forms a, you know, bend. A bend is the flexure. The right colic flexure or the hepatic flexure. That's the only thing it's doing, okay? The right colic flexure or the hepatic flexure is formed by the ascending colon. And then it continues as, you know, what is called the transverse colon. The transverse colon has a mesocolon. You may remember that it has a mesocolon. So what is its relationship to the peritoneum when it has a mesocolon? Intraperitoneal. So as a result, the transverse colon can hang down. In some people, it can be even this far down, you know, into the pelvic region even. So if you're doing colon therapy, there may be, you know, some measures that you need to use to feel and to find where the transverse, you know, colon is. Even though, you know, you don't go that far, but anyway, so it can hang, so it's not sitting right up where you expect it to be, okay? And the transverse colon is the longest part, and it comes and forms a flexure here, and as you look at it here, that is forming the left colic flexure, or the splenic flexure, the left colic flexure or the splenic flexure. So left colic flexure or the splenic flexure. The other, you know, thing here, you know, about the sigma, this part here is that this is where, as you look at it here, this is where the mid-gut derivatives terminate immediately after or at that left colic flexure is where the mid-gut derivatives, you know, terminate, and then your hindgut, this is where the hindgut derivatives begin, and therefore, look at it, in this section, this is where you can see here, so the blood supply up to here is via your superior mesenteric artery. Here is the branches here, you see, superior mesenteric branches coming here. And the hindgut derivatives receive blood supply from the inferior mesenteric. Look at it here. Here's the inferior mesenteric, and you can see its branches coming up here. Look at the anastomosis here. So here you can see it's anastomosis there to make sure that part has, you know, blood supply. So it's not that the superior mesenteric terminates here and the inferior mesenteric starts there. That's not the case. And so here you can see. And so this is where, at the left colic flexure, or an inch below the left colic flexure, is where the mid-gut derivatives terminate. That means up to there, you have the blood supply from the superior mesenteric artery. And so then we go, the descending colon is secondary retroperitoneal. And because, remember, I talked to you about that story about, you know, how the small intestine comes. And that, of course, is secondary. And then it comes right down here as the sigmoid. Where does the sigmoid colon, you know, then, you know, begin? The sigmoid colon begins, you know, at the pelvic inlet, or at the, it is located at the iliac fossa, you can see. And as you look in here, here, this here, where my hand is, coming from here, in here, is the true pelvis. We will be doing the pelvis. This part here is the false pelvis, okay? False or the greater pelvis, true pelvis, small pelvis, all this, okay? And so it's about here, it's at the iliac, you know, the iliac crest is here, and so this is about here where you have into the true pelvis where it's going, you know, at the inlet. This is the pelvic inlet. At the pelvic inlet, so here you can see, here you have the sigmoid colon. And the sigmoid colon, again, is what is its peritoneal relationship? And why do you think I'm asking you the peritoneal relationship of some of these structures? What is the peritoneal relationship of the sigmoid colon? Intraperitoneal. And why do you think I ask the relationship of the sigmoid colon and transverse colon? Because they may not be in the right, in the place where you expect it to be. Because it has a mesentery, it can be in different places. Look at it here. In this diagram here, there's okay. Here we have, okay, here. Look at the different configurations. Here is the sigmoid colon. Look, here is the ileum right here. You can see part of it. The other part is coming straight. Look at it, some part here, and it is curved right up to here. And look at this here. So these, the structures that have viscera, not viscera, the structures that have a mesentery can move about. And so then look at the configuration here. This is the sigmoid colon here. How far high has it come up? So this is the S1 here, L5, L4, you know, L3, and even a little higher than L3. And normally you should not see it here. Because it has the mesentery, it can be found in some other place other than, you know, the true pelvis and at the pelvic inlet where it's supposed to begin. Okay, and then we go to the sigmoid colon, and it has the mesentery. Then I go to the blood supply. The rectum I'll do after, because now we are finishing the colon, okay? And so after I finish the colon, the blood supply of the colon, as you look at it here, we have the blood supply. Let's go here, okay. Blood supply. You already know right up to there we have the superior mesenteric, and the right up to here you have the inferior mesenteric, that's the blood supply. And then the venous return is via the same vein, named veins. Superior mesenteric vein and the inferior mesenteric vein going into where though? Superior mesenteric and the inferior mesenteric veins going into where? Where do you think they will go to? The portal vein. So here, this is the superior mesenteric vein. And so here it is going And then here is the inferior mesenteric vein. The inferior mesenteric vein goes and joins up with the splenic vein. The inferior mesenteric vein joins up with the splenic vein here. And now we have just one splenic vein here. And so the splenic vein and the superior mesenteric vein together form the hepatic portal vein. The hepatic portal vein is formed by the splenic vein and the superior mesenteric vein. And you know where the portal vein is going, into the